It's a great honor for me to be here at the Empire Club of Canada today, which is arguably the most famous and historically relevant speaker's podium to have ever existed in Canada. It has offered its podium to such international luminaries as Winston Churchill, Ronald Reagan, Audrey Hepburn, the Dalai Lama, Indira Gandhi, and closer to home, from Pierre Trudeau to Justin Trudeau. Literally generations of our great nation's leaders, alongside with those of the world's top international diplomats, heads of state, and business and thought leaders.
It is a real honor and a distinct privilege to be invited to speak to the Empire Club of Canada, which has been welcoming international diplomats, leaders in business and in science and in politics. When they stand at that podium, they speak not only to the entire country, but they can speak to the entire world.
Good evening, and welcome to the Empire Club of Canada. My name is Sal Rabani, and it's an honor to stand before our community as chair of the Board of Directors of the Empire Club of Canada. To formally begin this event, I want to acknowledge that we're gathering today on the traditional and treaty lands of the Mississaugas of the Credit and the homelands of the Anishinaabe, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples. We encourage everyone to learn more about the traditional territory on which you work and live. The Empire Club of Canada is a not-for-profit organization, and we'd like to recognize our sponsors who generously support the club and make these events possible and complimentary for our online audience to attend. Thank you to our lead event sponsor, Waste Connections of Canada. Not too easy, but thanks, Izzy. And thank you to our season sponsors, AWS, Bruce Power, and Hydro One. A warm welcome to our distinguished guests for today. We have a fantastic discussion ahead. For 120 years, the Empire Club of Canada has hosted important voices on topics relevant to our distinguished community. We've had business people, influencers, game changers, and politicians of all colors and at all levels of government. A week ago, we hosted the Honorable Peter Bethenfall, the Ontario's Minister of Finance, delivering his annual pre-budget address. And next week, we'll welcome Bonnie Crombie in one of her first major speaking appearances as Ontario's new Liberal leader. And we've welcomed civil society representatives who have analyzed the evolving democratic process, much like we're going to do today. These are all fundamental voices and conversations about our collective future for all 16 million of us Ontarians. Open dialogue is the cornerstone of an informed and healthy society. We're proud to continue to bring you different and diverse points of view. So please engage in the conversation and voice your questions to the panel today at the end, and I think there is a QR code there, or there'll be somebody walking around with a microphone to take a question, and you'll have it. And it's through really meaningful conversations and diverse opinions and positions that we can move forward together and to help build the province that we want for ourselves and for our future generations. We near the halfway point of Premier Doug Ford's second mandate, and we'll have a conversation about that. And with the election of Bonnie Crombie as the leader of the Liberal Party in December, the main protagonists of the next Ontario election are now set. As we reflect on the mandate of the current government, there are quite a few topics for today's conversation. What are the main reactions to the provincial budget that was just released 2 days ago? How has Merritt Stiles fared in her first year on the job as leader of His Majesty's official opposition? Will the Ford government need to recalibrate policy to respond to the recent changes in political leadership? And what will Bonnie Crombie's election mean for Ontario Liberals? There are also many federal hot topics with implications at the provincial level, education, healthcare, carbon tax, topics that have garnered considerable attention in recent news coverage. So a lot to discuss and analyze for our panel. And let's get going by welcoming to the stage your moderator, Adrian Batra, editor-in-chief of the Toronto Sun, and today's panelists.
Thank you. Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you to the Empire Club for having us here tonight for what I hope to be a rigorous conversation. I wore white just in case I have to hurl myself in front of any of them as the white flag, just in case. Or they may have to come after me if in case I get involved in this conversation. I am Adrienne Batra. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Toronto Sun. I would like to introduce our panelists, all of whom I'm sure are familiar to each and every one of you. And I'm going to start all the way to, ironically, my right, Brad Levine.
They're left.
Of course, many of you know Brad. He's a partner at Council Public Affairs. He has been in and around NDP politics at the provincial and federal level for many, many years, probably longer than he cares to admit, so I won't I won't date him by any means. So welcome, Brad.
Thank you.
And Genevieve Tomney, again, another face is probably familiar to all of you. Genevieve is a principal at GT & Company Executive Advisors. She has served with former Premier Kathleen Wynne, and most recently has helped Bonnie Crombie on her leadership campaign. So welcome, Genevieve. Thanks. Thank you. And Corey Tenike, again, a very familiar face. We're going to have a contest at the end who gets the most claps. It's kind of going to be a little bit like Survivor, maybe not. Corey Tenike, of course, is the co-founder and CEO of Rubicon Strategy, and you know him from in and around conservative politics for many years, and of course is the campaign manager on Premier Doug Ford's two successful majority elections. So welcome, Corey.
Thank you.
Well, let's start off with an easy one. I am going to have each of you discuss it from the perspective of your political party, shall we say. Let's start with the as our introduction was in around the budget. That is the most recent example of significant spending, triple the deficit, hundreds of billions of dollars in new spending, a $202 billion budget. Corey, I'm going to start with you. Tell us a little bit about the priorities in that budget, why they came forward, and will it ever be enough for the opposition?
Well, I'll answer the last part first. I'm going to guarantee you that they're not going to like whatever the government has to say, but that's sort of the system we have. Look, there's a lot of spending in the budget, but what is the spending around? It's largely around infrastructure. One of the things that I think a lot of people don't appreciate is the rate of growth that Ontario is experiencing right now. If you look at the United States, the two fastest growing states in south of the border are Texas and Florida. And Ontario is growing at greater rate than both of those two states combined in terms of its population. The amount of pressure that that's putting on infrastructure, you know, whether it's hospitals, whether it's our roads, whether it's our transit, whether it's our schools, is really unprecedented. You'd have to go back to sort of the formation of the province and you know the wave of United Empire loyalists to sort of see percentage growth of the type that we're going through. So it's you know that creates a whole lot of challenges. It also creates a lot of opportunities for the province. But a lot of that money that you're seeing spent is really centered around those sorts of core infrastructure items. There's also, you know, a number of things related to economic growth, particularly around the areas of skills training. Much to Brad's chagrin, the private sector labor union movement in Ontario is now four square behind the Conservative Party, and is really leading the effort of training the workers that we need to build that core infrastructure, which is something that is not only remaking the province, but it's also remaking the politics in, I think, a very sustained way in terms of what electoral coalitions look like here in this province and, I think, you know, federally as well.
Genevieve, Bonnie Crombie said this of the budget. This is a do-nothing budget. It's not worth the paper it's written on. There's nothing in the budget to help families dealing with the affordability crisis. So $212 billion is what was spent. What is her chief concern
with this budget.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There was an editorial in your paper this week that said that Doug Ford talks like a conservative and spends like a liberal.
Well, don't take away my question. I was going to ask Corey, is Doug Ford still a fiscal conservative?
And I think that's exactly the kind of framing that they were hoping for coming out of this, right? But it's a little bit of a misnomer because people are rightly asking themselves, when this much money is being spent, where is it going? And is it actually helping me? And is it helping me feel better in my day-to-day life? I think there's a lot of anxiety that people are feeling right now out there about their own households, about how they're going to pay for childcare, how they're going to pay for their mortgage, how they're going to pay for their rent. And I think the tinkering at the edges that we're seeing in this budget is not actually helping to get at some of those big problems that people are feeling. And I think healthcare is one of those big areas that comes to mind for me, because if I'm looking at this and I'm seeing a government that is spending billions of dollars basically to make up for the fact that it's dragged nurses into court over wages, and then I'm sitting in an emergency room for 6 hours, I'm not seeing the benefit of that money. And I think that that's the big disconnect that's happening for me.
Brad, Mart Stiles said of this budget that this does nothing to help the daily lives of Ontarians. Can you expand on that from the perspective?
Let's build on the points that were made. It's not just 6 hours that folks are waiting in emergency. It's quite a lot longer, and it could be up to like 20 hours, which is three times what this government's kind of goal is. That the goal of this government, after 6 years of Doug Ford's government, his goal is to have you only wait 8 hours, and in fact, many Ontarians are waiting up to 20 hours. That's the first thing. We have 2.2 million Ontarians don't have a family doctor. We had about 203 closures of emergency wards last year, and it's only going to get worse. So on healthcare, it's bad. Half of our universities are either in deficit or projecting deficits in the near term. And it's only going to be, I think, their financial bottom line is only going to be made worse with some of the decisions that have been made over international students. So if you care about education, to say nothing of the K-12 infrastructure deficit, that it won't be touched in any significant way by this budget. If any of those areas, whether healthcare or education, concern you or your family, then this budget, which I think, you know, many of the conservatives I work with say, it's great budget because it was in and out of the cycle within a couple of days. That's only when you have bad news. If it's good news budget, and halfway through a mandate, you can say, well, you know, it's kind of here or there. This should have been an opportunity. If we take a look at the growth, it's fixation on things which are, you know, can be obviously important, things like roads and infrastructure, where the government wants to trumpet that. But the other infrastructure that we as Ontarians face day to day, I think, has been left aside. Nothing is going to come from this budget where people will wake up in 4, 6, 8, or 12 months and say, thank God for 2024 budget, because it's by and large either off to the future. And I think it's a government that doesn't really know where it wants to go, other than investing in roads and some infrastructure. What about the rest of the ledger? And that's where I think people are going to shrug and say, there's nothing in this budget for me. If I want to change in Ontario, this budget was not the budget.
Okay, well, I think Corey wants to respond.
Just to make it real for you, because, you know, that's a nice story. It's just not a true story. Why did the Conservatives win two seats in the Windsor area, for instance, for the first time in 60 years at the expense of the NDP? One of the reasons is because we're building a new hospital in Windsor. That's very real to the people in Windsor. And so when you make statements like that, Brad, I think it's a little bit misleading, and it negates, I think, what has been driving some of the growth of the Conservative Party and would have been traditional NDP areas. I want to talk a little bit about affordability, because Jen mentioned that, and I think that's, if we're looking writ large, it's the biggest driver of political change in the country right now. Normally, healthcare is the number one issue. It's kind of the number three issue now, with different versions of affordability leading.
But bubbling back up again.
If you look at affordability and how that issue is being characterized in the minds of most Canadian voters and most voters in Ontario, it's very focused on the carbon tax. An issue that is, you know, very uncomfortable for two of the parties on this stage.
Who had 620? That's a new record.
It was actually mentioned in the introduction. So it was more like 604.
He submitted it for the intro.
And you know, if we're talking about things for affordability, you're not paying any gas tax in Ontario right now, which is a pretty considerable saving. You have a number of other measures around affordability. One fare is, you know, another one that's saving people who use transit about $1,500 a year. So there are a number of issues that are good. We actually stole that one from Stephen Del Duca. I saw you, Tilia, here. So, you know, we can take good ideas from all the parties. and that's one that is certainly helping on the affordability side of things. But carbon tax, I think the biggest single issue right now in Ontario electorate, and really we've got two parties, you know, dividing up, actually three parties dividing up 40% of the vote, and you got 60% of the vote with one other party. Guess which one is swimming in a lot bigger, deeper pool of electoral success.
Okay, both Genevieve and Brad want to weigh on this, but Genevieve, I'm just going to come to you first, just since we've mentioned the C word already, let's go down the road. It is certainly hurting Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in the polls. The notion of the carbon tax is going up on April 1st. It's our April Fool's joke, as we say. It's going up 23%. It is really hurting Canadians. Does that translate into Bonnie Crombie's position on the carbon tax? Because she was very much in favor of it, but is she changing her idea on that?
It's a bit of a reach to say she was very much in favor of it, but it's not a surprise to anybody in this room that Doug Ford is going to pick up on Pierre Poilievre's success with the carbon tax and making that the only affordability issue that anyone's talking about. I think it's important for everybody to also remember that we wouldn't have a carbon tax in Ontario if Doug Ford hadn't taken the opportunity as soon as he came into office to rip up the Made in Ontario climate plan that already existed, which meant that a carbon tax wouldn't need to be here in Ontario. So I think Bonnie Crombie's position has been very clear that we can get to a place where we can create a Made in Ontario solution that works for Ontario, that makes sense for what people are facing right now and actually thinks about the future and what we need to do, and not sticking our heads in the sand and pretending that the province isn't burning every summer.
So unequivocally, Bonnie Crombie, absolutely in favor of a carbon tax.
There is no plan for a provincial carbon tax in Ontario. There will be.
Just so we're clear.
A Made in Ontario solution.
So, I saw my friend Martin from the start here, so he's got it.
Anyway, clarity and carbon tax in association with Bonnie Crombie is like not something that's ever going to be associated.
Brad, the NDP's position on the carbon tax is a pretty straightforward path.
Yeah,
in favor?
No, we voted just this morning. There was a private member's bill calling, and NDP voted in favor. And in fact, Ontario Democrats have voted in favor of every motion in the at Queen's Park opposed to the carbon price. You should know that because you probably monitor Queen's Park and your colleagues. So, but I just want to maybe the reason why we pay a carbon tax in Ontario is because Doug Ford took away the plan that we had in place.
Exactly.
It's a backstop. So every time he rails against it, he's actually railing against a policy that he himself brought in, or if he had his own Made in Ontario plan, he would do so. But I think we should, if we can.
Good luck getting that on a bumper sticker and selling it in the next election.
We're not writing the bumper stickers tonight. That's next week. We're waiting. Tonight we're developing attacks on Bonnie and Doug. But Bonnie's party today, what did they do, Corey? Anybody from the office? They abstained. They did not have a position on whether or not
they should call it.
They abstained, though, today on today's motion and on previous motions since Bonnie became. So she's going to have to figure this out quickly because, you know, there's only 2 years before the next election. And I doubt that with the look ahead in the economy, and we see that from the budget documents, that Ontario is headed for a difficult economic period. Look at the growth. What was it, 0.3%? It's less than 1% potential, and that's from the Ontario government. So I think Bonnie's going to have to put it together. Carbon pricing, the carbon tax is not something that all center-left parties agree with. In fact, when I was in Parliament Hill We ran against it. It was the signature policy of Stéphane Dion in 2008, and we vehemently opposed it then. We've opposed it on and off in various provincial parties. In BC, they're in favor of it. It was brought in by the Conservative government of Gordon Campbell. It's now in place, and it's entrenched, and the public likes it.
Wait, what?
I think it's a Liberal Party.
No,
BC Liberal Party.
Have you looked at it? But the point is, a price on carbon isn't automatically progressive. And in fact, there are much better mechanisms to reduce our carbon footprint than merely a carbon tax. You shouldn't say carbon tax or nothing. If you want to bring down greenhouse gases, you don't have to embrace a carbon tax. It's one vehicle. And I believe that in this country, it's swinging opposed to it. I don't think it's just Pierre Poilievre, because we got New Democrats in Alberta who are opposed to it as well.
But not the one important one who's propping up the Liberal government in Ottawa, named Jagmeet Singh, who is actually the reason that why we still have a carbon tax and we haven't gone to an election campaign,
which
most Canadians want.
So you can get a sense and a tone of what the next election is going to be like for the next two and a half years. This is a very, very long time away. The next provincial election is, October 2020. Genevieve, I want to talk a little bit about Bonnie Crombie in terms of her running for a seat. Obviously, she's decided Milton is not where she wants to give it a shot. How effective, because we've seen it in the past, leaders outside of the House don't have as much of an effect as they do certainly inside the legislature. That doesn't mean to say she still doesn't have the profile, she still has an ability to garner attention, but is there a seat in the offing? Is there something that you guys are cooking up that we should all break tonight?
Well, we'll just have to wait and see how many more ministers resign from Doug Ford's cabinet before
we can really truly decide
on that.
Well, you'd have to actually decide to run and sort of not be chicken and actually put your name in front of an electorate to do that. If you can't win seats like Milton, then there isn't much of a path for the Liberal Party.
So I think that there is a choice that's being made in the current two by-elections to run strong local candidates and to really be able to put those people forward and put them in the window. I think that Bonnie Crombie has a profile, particularly in the GTA, but not really very much outside of the GTA in Ontario. And so there's a real effort being made to travel around, to visit different communities, and to introduce Bonnie Crombie to Ontario, because it's very difficult to do that when you're stuck in the legislature every day. And so this is really an opportunity to get out, to have those conversations, to talk to the real people who Doug Ford is ignoring right now, and really find out what the needs are on the ground. And so as we're putting together a platform and policy, we can respond to those needs.
Brad, Brad, your take, missed opportunity for Bonnie Crombie to take an opportunity to get a seat?
It signals to me that her people believe that this would either be too close or she would lose it, and the risk is too great, which suggests to me that the Liberal brand in that region is not as strong as it has been traditionally. So I think it's a sign of weakness as opposed to anything else.
It's a classic swing seat. Milton's a classic swing seat.
It's a close race.
I agree. Having strong candidates is important. Mm-hmm. I think the Liberal candidate's like a 22-year-old, former staffer. This is not the sort of
current staffer.
This is kind of what you call sacrificial lamb territory for candidate recruitment, as opposed to actually getting strong community leaders. I think you have a good candidate in Ellen Kay. But I think, inability to find, good candidates and attract good candidates is a reflection of where the Liberals are in the polls.
As the only millennial sitting on the platform right now, I will say that actually attracting candidates who are under the age of 40 is actually something that people in Ontario want to see right now. And I think that because somebody is young, because they have chosen to engage in politics as their work at that young age, doesn't write them off as being somebody who is engaged with their community.
Okay, we are going to carry on with our panel, but do please keep in mind, we are going to take questions from the floor. I'm not going to have an opportunity, of course, ask them everything I want to, because I'm not going to make this into a Toronto Sun editorial board meeting. But we want to give you certainly an opportunity to have put a question to any of our three panelists, because it's so rare to have an opportunity when you've got this much closeness to power, so to speak. So please think of your questions, and we'll keep it respectful as much as we can. And I want to talk about one specific area that has really engulfed the Tory, the Ford government in the last year. And I would argue the most success that the opposition parties has had in some time, since Marat Stiles certainly was elected leader, and that was on the Greenbelt. And the Greenbelt was a mess in terms of the layout, the strategy, the plan, and then the ultimate clawback from it. So, Corey, can you give us a little bit of a understanding of what the hell happened there?
Well, look, I don't think it's a mystery as to why that was unpopular. If you say you're not going to do something and you make a promise that you're not going to do something and then you do that thing, people are going to be disappointed in you. I think that, you know, every political leader has some superpower. And I think the superpower that Doug Ford has and why, you know, the numbers are more or less where they were on election day is because he can course correct.
Yeah.
And I've only known one other politician in my lifetime who's had that sort of ability at a same level, and that would be Ralph Klein in Alberta. And I think it's almost intrinsically a part of his brand. And others say, oh, well, he's going to reverse. Well, keep saying that, because it's like one of the most popular things when you ask the electorate about what do they actually like about Ford and his leadership. It is the ability to course correct.
Brad, I've said that is probably one of the most successful pieces of public policy that the opposition had in terms of getting Premier Ford to change positions. I mean, they were very strong on it. Day after day, they were hammering the provincial government. I suspect that Premier Ford had already decided that he was going to change course, as Corey says. But that said, to the point where it was successful for the opposition, they could go out and say, look, we got Doug Ford to change his position and nothing's coming out of the green belt. Everything's fine and dandy. But yet it didn't move the needle at all in terms of public opinion with respect to the NDP. And I'm wondering why.
If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be up here. I would be down the street running their campaign. The interesting thing about Corey's answer just now is that he didn't answer your question. What he said was what the ultimate outcome was, which was the premier. And it's a superpower when you do something so egregious as that, the green belt, that is not only flip-flopping on a promise, because many governments do that. That's not the first original sin here. But it was the way in which it was secretive. There were staff involved. There were developers that had donated to the party who were going to be very, very rich off this policy turnaround. That is what I think gave it so much juice. It was a very interesting story. And the problem was, and we know this from crisis comms, and sometimes the conservatives and governments are good at it, and sometimes they're not, but it's the drip, drip, drip. Something new came out all the time. And sometimes it contradicted what was going on, what the government was saying. So it made it for a very compelling story. And it was because the Green Belt has a special place. For some reason, the Green Belt, we just kind of drive through it at 120 kilometers an hour, but a lot of people find this something of an attachment. And when that's upset, I think it touched a nerve. And I don't think there was any other option other than Ford backstab. But we can't negate the greasy, slimy stuff that was going on in the background, that it just wasn't, oh, we made a mistake, he changed course, isn't he great? It was, this party had a very corrupt cancer within it, somewhere within the its bowels, and it got exposed. And the opposition helped expose it, the media helped expose it, and he got caught. And then we gotta give him credit for switching on some things, but when you get your hand in the cookie jar, and you get caught, and you say, I switched positions, and everyone says, oh, good for you, you've done that. We can't forget the reason why, which led us to that. And that's why I think it was a good day for the opposition, and I agree with you. Well, it was Marat's shining moment.
But
in terms of, you know, a good day, you know, normally if you have a good day, you don't go down in the polls. And what's so perplexing about the NDP as the official opposition and all of these sort of supposedly very effective attacks on the Greenbelt, they dropped 4 points. So, I don't know. You can't withstand too much more success like that. You know,
Genevieve, it did take up a lot of oxygen out of the room for the government for a long period of time, to be sure.
Yeah.
It did take some time for it to course correct. Three cabinet ministers resigned in as many weeks. Two are arguably directly involved with respect to the Greenbelt scandal. One sort of separate, happened to be maybe bad timing, I don't know, but nonetheless. I'm wondering, from the Liberals' perspective, there have been some scandals in previous Liberal governments. When your party was responding to how this was ongoing and recognizing the minimal number of Liberal MPPs right now, how do you get yourself around a scandal like that? How do you guys make sure that your message is heard as well, with not that as much opportunity for it in the House, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really being clear about what the message is. And I think that reducing this one to a flip-flop is actually doing a kindness to the Conservative government, because this wasn't some oopsie, this was deliberate. And I think what was really different about this one was that it was Doug Ford, in a way, kind of breaking that covenant that he made with the people of Ontario, that I'm here for you, I'm here for the little guy. And I think it really raised the question that I think is going to be the core question for Doug Ford as we head into 2026, which is, who are you actually in this for? Who are you actually fighting for? Is it the little guy like you said it is? Or is it the developers? Is it the big business? Is it the CEOs who you seem to be more inclined to help right now? And I think that's really the frame that we need to take.
Well, I hope that is the ballot question with Bonnie Crombie, with her Birkin bag and a Hermes scarf, standing next to Doug Ford, talking about who actually can relate to people at an emotive level.
Same developers, both Bonnie and Doug took the money from the same developers. So there's no blame.
So, like,
there.
I just don't think that's a great narrative thread for the Liberal Party, especially when it comes to the development community, because as you correctly point out, you look at the donation records they give to everybody, and in the same way.
I don't think you want to leave that one, Genevieve. I think you want to respond to that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this was a very, very different situation than developers choosing to pepper around donations to every political party, which they do. And also, are we really going to continue commenting on what bag a woman carries and what she wears? Because I really just don't think that that's where we want to go.
But the challenge, of course, is inevitably, as distasteful as it is, it happens. And that's part of the unfortunate narrative in the political world. But I want to move on, to Brad with respect to this issue of what the next election will spell out for Marit Stiles, as Bonnie Crombie will be out there more. More Ontarians will certainly get to know her. More Ontarians will sort of recognize that maybe we are Liberals at the end of the day, and that's who we want to go back to come the 2026 provincial election. How does the NDP calculate for hanging on to the seats that they have and making sure they don't lose them to the Liberals?
Well, people said that about, I remember when Stephen Del Duca was elected leader, they said, he's an organizer, he's a great fundraiser, we're going to roll over. And he didn't rise to the occasion. Now, obviously, Bonnie's quite different, but within the next 2 years, I think the New Democratic Party of Ontario has to do a few things. One, Marit, I think she's had good days and days that she might have learned from. And I think the Greenbelt is a good example of a good day. The consensus of the party, even those that wanted to run for leader, once it was inevitable that there would be a leadership race, saw in Marit somebody who could take the party to the next level. And so they stood down. So there's a bit of a consensus there. The Sarah Jama incident was very informative. And it was a good test. And you'd rather go through your tests early in your mandate than at the end of the, like, you know, weeks before election day. What she's been able to do coming out of that, and there were certainly mistakes made, and I would not suggest that there weren't. But what that has done is that it's united the caucus around her. The debt's paid off. Organizers have been hired throughout the province. Election planning committees in place. The one thing that she's got that Horvath never had, and that is the reason why she's in it is to win. As opposed to, I want to be the leader because it's nice to be the leader, or I want to stand in question period and hold the government to account. That's a fundamental difference. It's one of the reasons why I was drawn to her leadership early, before it was known that there was nobody else there. Because I'm only involved in electoral politics for the purposes of winning, as opposed to making good points. So she's got that, and she's changing the culture within the party. So those are all good. There will be a runoff for the non-conservative vote primary, as is in all three-party states, when you've got a center party and a progressive party and a conservative party. The taking on Bonnie Crombie will be as important, in my opinion, and I'm not representing the party here tonight, but in my opinion, taking on Crombie and really taking to task liberal history will be important, and what the liberals stand for and what they don't stand for. And Bonnie Crombie has a track record that I think can be really emphasized in the coming 2 years. To ultimately win that progressive primary, the non-conservative primary, in order to then be the inevitable standard bearer against Doug Ford. So we can kick Doug Ford all day and maybe hope some of those blue switchers come loose. There's some orange blue switchers as well, and in some of the industrial areas. Corey mentioned Windsor, that's certainly the case. The 519 is full of them, and the North are full of them. Primarily, when you saw the collapse of the Wynn coalition, some of it came to the Democrats, but also a lot of it went to the Tories. Mm-hmm. So the Liberals have a two-pronged war to fight. They have to get the blue-red switchers back, and they have to get the red-orange switchers back. And so Crombie is somebody that is going to have a harder time getting those red-orange switchers back than she will the blue. So the hope is that as Crombie grows, she takes more from the Tory-Liberal switchers than the other, but she has to increase her profile. She has to raise a crap load more money.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of work that Mara has to do, without question. But the good news is she's been in for a year. She's got some of the sea legs underneath her, and I think she's starting the campaign well before any of her predecessors ever did, which is, I think, a step in the right direction.
Okay, so Genevieve. Picking up on similar with respect to the NDP, as for Bonnie Crombie, she's, again, going to be out there. We've already discussed when, she's not planning on running in any of these by-elections, or maybe it's too late now, but something else will pop up, certainly before the next election. That will be an interesting thing to watch, where it will be, does she win, et cetera. But what is on the agenda for the Liberals moving forward? As Brad said, you can kick the shit out of Doug Ford day in, day out, and that's, it's easy to beat up on the guy that's there right now. But none of that is moving the needle in terms of public opinion on Doug Ford. So what is Bonnie going to do?
So when Brad was talking about needing to raise profile and raise a shit ton of cash, I actually thought he was talking about Bonnie Crombie, because that's exactly what the Ontario Liberals need to do as well, right? You need to get out there and you need to introduce this person to Ontario, because again, you've got some profile in the GTA, you've been the mayor of Mississauga for 10 years, fine. What about the rest of the province? And quite frankly, you can't do that without money. And so another part of the reason why we're not running Bonnie in a by-election is to be able to get out there and be on the fundraising path to be able to raise that money and raise the war chest that's going to be needed to be able to start to make a dent in what Ford's got going on. And I think that's really the main goal right now. Introduce the leader, get her narrative out there, and raise money.
You're going to love this. You're going to get the last word.
We're introducing the leader right now.
Thank you.
With a multi-million dollar ad campaign.
Incorrectly.
So that's part of it. Defining your enemy before they define themselves.
Well,
and unfortunately, Genevieve, they are doing just that. Go ahead, sir.
If someone could invent a political time machine and loaned it to Justin Trudeau and his team, do you think that they would go and take that time machine and go back and do a definitional branding campaign on Poilievre before he could do one on himself? Mm-hmm. I think they would probably choose to do that. And when I've seen campaigns that have worked well, the election is won well before the actual campaign starts, and it's usually through that framing and branding exercise. I think of Stéphane Dion, I think of Michael Ignatieff, I would like to add Bonnie Crombie to the next on that list of of successfully branded opposition leaders for the Liberal Party.
Okay, now we're going to take, thank you all. I appreciate that. I didn't have to fling myself in front of anybody for a white flag. We have a few minutes for some questions from the audience, and this has been a very interesting conversation, but we didn't cover it all. So you clearly must have something to ask. Martin, you don't get to ask questions, not Scrum. Please, someone take the microphone from Kent, who's standing up here at the front. Now, okay, right up here front, right up front here. Kent, right up here. You could also just yell.
Name an organization, please.
Hi, I'm Megan. I work with the colleges, so I'm going to ask you a question about post-secondary, which is actually kind of the one thing you can all agree on, which is undervaluing our post-secondary institutions. Tuition freeze, all three of you guys or your parties can agree on that. And that's a challenge because it's starving, especially our colleges. We're the second least funded in the country, lowest tuition in the country, second lowest tuition in the country. We don't have highways without college graduates. We don't have daycares without college graduates. We don't have pharmacies without pharmacy techs coming from colleges. Why isn't there a vote there? Like, what is the issue from the, like, the vote grab? That's what I want to know.
Okay, so I think that was a pretty clear question with respect to the funding of colleges. Not enough resources within there. Corey, let's start with you. Let's talk about it a bit based on what just happened in the provincial budget.
Well, the government's putting a little more than $1 billion additional dollars into the sector. So it's, you know, there is a lot of money going into that sector. I think there's something, if you want to talk about the colleges side, there's a really big sea change happening when you look at the skilled trades in particular, where it's, you look at the graduation rates of colleges for things, programs like electrical workers. It's like their graduation rates are like 1 in 4. The unions and their training programs graduated like 98-99%. And so I think there's been a decision to move more money out of the colleges system and into that union training environment because of a higher efficacy in those certain areas. I think in other areas, there's a changed approach, and I think there's probably more that we agree on than disagree on in some of this. You know, you don't have to pay for a nursing degree anymore. The government will pay 100% of that in exchange for you signing a contract to go to a place where we have a vacancy in the public system. The Learn and Stay program, I think, is something that will live on beyond this government and be copied in other jurisdictions. Look, I personally, think tuition rates should go up, and the government should allow that to happen. But I also understand why in this particular environment, why that is a really difficult thing to take to students and their families, and say, well, you are struggling to pay your mortgage or your rent or your grocery bill, etc., that we're going to increase the price of schooling as well. I think that's a really tough sell in this environment. But, do I think there needs to be more money in the system? Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Genevieve, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to look at this from an economy perspective as well, right? Like, there's a direct through line that you can follow from post-secondary to the sluggish growth that's happening in our economy right now, right? You talked about all of the new immigrants that we have coming to Ontario more than anywhere else in the country, and yet our economy is completely stalled out. And so I think that, yes, more investment is necessary, but I think we have to look like at potentially really blowing it up and looking at, where we're funding, what universities are, what the landscape even needs to look like. I think we have to look at it more broadly than just throwing more money at the problem, because I think that it's more nuanced than that.
Brad?
I think that tuition fee freezes and reductions are good because they increase accessibility of those that would traditionally be left outside of the system. But I also think that it's dependent upon the government to constantly keep up with an internal rate of inflation, which may be higher than the CPI. I know that internally in post-secondary education, there's higher rates of costs going up. The government's going to have to decide whether or not it wants to. I quite like the direction in which we're heading. I found that there was it was absolutely abhorrent how we would take folks from away, China, India in particular, and allow these fly-by-night private colleges above nail salons, and they would literally give them, and then they rely on the public system to draw
because they get the accreditation, and then they get to hold that up, and then it's also an immigration backdoor. So I hope that we continue to have that conversation, because far too many people, I think, are coming to Ontario for the wrong reasons to our private colleges. I would fund the tuition fee reductions dollar for dollar, with the internal rate of inflation in mind.
Well, the core of that was immigration fraud, right? Like, and you know, and I think it's a, you know, I think there's a responsibility both at the provincial level and also at the federal level,
yes,
in terms of what I think is being one of the more abject policy failures we've, yes, seen over the last few years.
Agree.
You know, I think we had 3 years ago about 150,000 foreign students here. We are 411,000 this,
yeah,
year. We're going to be like 650,000 next year if the province and the federal government hadn't stepped in to shut that system down. But,
yeah,
you know, it's, look, my heart bleeds for the people who were brought here on false,
that's,
pretenses.
Right.
And, you well, know, and, it's
also adding
shame
to our housing. It's also adding to the housing problem.
It's absolutely
one of the reasons
adding to the housing problem.
We're having a crisis with all
but
of it.
The housing portion of this, it's important to note that universities have housing for the foreign students that they bring in.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They really are not a part of what that problem is. And a number of colleges also do as well. So, like, we're, you know, there's a lot being done correct in terms of what we're doing with foreign students. It's just, you know, this thing, you know, morphed into,
yeah,
you know, a system with, you know, I think 4,800 private colleges right now in, yeah, Ontario.
Underground.
Okay, we have enough time for one more question, and each panelist
easier
will answer it.
Okay, awesome.
So you get the last question. Make it good.
Yeah. So my name's Alex. I guess I'm from Altus Group. So Corey said something about leaders and superpowers. I'm going to rephrase that to strengths. So what's Bonnie Crombie's greatest strength? To Genevieve, what's Merritt's? And to Brad, what's Doug Ford's?
No. Okay.
Oh.
Okay. So Brad gets to go first.
Oh, do I?
Yeah.
Why?
Do you want
what
me to rag
I
the puck a bit so you can think of an answer?
No. No. I won't steal his ability to climb down from bad decisions is one, but it's already been stated. I think he's actually an effective communicator.
Okay, Genevieve.
I think Marit shows a lot of empathy in her communications. She really is able to connect with people in that way.
Good one.
And finally, Mr. Tanaik.
I think Bonnie is, you know, a very good networker, very personable. Like, I think probably most people in this room know her and have probably known her for a long time. I personally think she's a very nice person, so. But, you know, I'm not really. My job is really not to emphasize the positive.
Answer the question.
Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it.
But
almost.
I do
almost
like her.
So close.
I do like her.
That's her strongest attribute.
She's likable enough.
She is likable.
She's likable enough. You want to run a note?
I want to thank our panelists, Brad Levine, Genevieve Tomney, and Corey Tanaik, for their insight tonight and a very rigorous conversation. And thank you to the Empire Club for hosting us, and thank you for participating and being great, great questions. And thank you very much. And I think I wrapped up right on time.
Well done.
Big thank you to our speakers and... I'd actually now like to welcome to the stage my outstanding first vice chair, Jenna Donaldson, to offer the appreciation remarks and close off tonight's event. Jenna.
Thank you, Sal. I think I am the only thing standing in between all of you and probably your vigorous debates about who had the best singer, judging by the feistiness of this crowd. But listen, I'd like to echo the thanks to all the panelists. And Adrian, I think you get a special round of applause for great moderating and a little bit of wrangling in there, too. I just want to say one thing. You know, Corey will remind us that nobody wants to talk about COVID still. But I will say that, you know, when we came out of COVID, it wasn't clear if these evening events were going to come back, if all of you were going to come back. And it is so great to feel the buzz in the room, to see standing room only because people wanted to come in. Thank you to all of our panelists again and to Adrian for bringing us back together. That's really, really special for us. And thank you as well to our sponsors who made this all happen. So thank you, Waste Connections, and our season sponsors as well, Hydro One, AWS, and Bruce Power. As a club of record, all Empire Club of Canada events are available on our website. The recording of this event will be available shortly, and everyone
wait,
registered.
Right.
No Chatham House rules here.
You want to go and redo? You want to redo a couple?
He wants a Bonnie question again.
Yeah.
Well,
I was going to say.
Well, I like her.
And Brad's given me the perfect segue.
I'll run that ad. Yeah, I'll run it. Corey likes Bonnie. Don't vote for Bonnie.
I'll get the tape later.
Sounds good. No doubt all of this will be captured in our recording. And Brad, you've given me the perfect segue. I hope you will join us on April 4th to hear from Liberal leader Bonnie Crombie at the Empire Club. Oh, no. And on April 12th, as we host Justice Michelle Obonzawin, a judge of the Supreme Court of Canada, who is here to talk about mental health. With that, I hope you will join us for more drinks, more conversation. Thank you again, everyone, and have a good night.